How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico. How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, Happy Friday! Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, Happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
Ruth Payne is central to the story of Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly killing President John F. Kennedy. As noted in the last episode, Ruth was the driving force in getting Lee the job at the Texas School Book Depository building in October, which put him working on the president's motorcade route on November 22nd. Ruth always said that her relationship with Marina was a simple act of altruism and that she wanted to help Marina while improving her own Russian by speaking with a native speaker who had just returned from the Soviet Union. But given the central role that was played by Ruth and to some extent her husband Michael in providing evidence to incriminate Lee Harvey Oswald, Warren Report critics have raised the possibility that the Payne's motive was not altruism. Instead, they argue that Ruth and possibly Michael were intelligence assets used to frame Oswald as a patsy. In this episode, we first look at a mysterious package sent to Oswald at the Payne home. Then we turn to the actions of Ruth and Michael Payne after the assassination of President Kennedy before summarizing the evidence that was provided by the Paynes to incriminate Lee Harvey Oswald. Was Ruth Payne a misunderstood Good Samaritan, or was she a key participant in the cover-up of the crime of the 21st century?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. 2 days before the assassination, a package was mailed from the post office in Irving that was addressed to Lee Harvey Oswald at Ruth Payne's house. This package was never delivered to the Payne home because no postage had been paid. 12 cents was still due. When the Dallas police searched the Payne home for a second time on November 23rd, they found a postage due notice with instructions for Lee Oswald to pick up and sign for the parcel that had been sent. So what was in this mysterious package? Dallas Postal Inspector Roy Armstrong told the FBI that the package had either a newspaper or a magazine inside of it, which is also the same thing that Ruth Payne told the postal inspector. But given that the package never actually arrived at the Payne home since postage was still due, there's no way that Ruth could have possibly known what was in it. This package was finally discovered on December 4th by Irving Postmaster C.G. Twilley in the Nixie section of the post office where they put parcels with unknown addresses. It makes sense that this package was found there in the Nixie section because it was sent to Oswald at an address that did not exist, 601 West Nassau Street, Dallas, Texas. So a postage due notice was found at Ruth Payne's house for Lee Oswald, but the post office had no actual package that was associated with Payne's address. The only package the post office had for Lee Oswald was the one sent to him at this non-existent 601 West Nassau Street address. Of course, none of this makes any sense. How could Ruth Payne have received a postage due notice at her house for a package that was supposed to be delivered to a completely different address? This enigmatic package was finally opened by Dallas Postal Inspector and FBI informant Harry Holmes, the same guy who had been reading Oswald's mail and who was present for his interrogation at the police station. Holmes said that the package contained, quote, a long brown bag opened at both ends. This paper bag was very similar to the paper sack that Oswald was said to have used to bring a rifle to the school book depository. But there was nothing else inside this package, just an 18-inch long open brown paper bag. The FBI checked the paper bag for fingerprints, but they weren't able to find any. Some Warren Report critics believe that this parcel may have been sent without postage to Oswald so that he would have to come in and pick it up at the post office, which would result in Oswald's fingerprints being on the brown paper bag that is the same material as the bag that was used to allegedly bring the rifle to the school book depository. When we look at the FBI's photo of this parcel, we can see that a mailing label for 601 West Nassau Street was applied over an existing handwritten address that said Irving, Texas on the bottom. This Irving, Texas address remained visible after the mailing label was applied, but no one ever pulled back the label to see exactly where the package was being sent in Irving before this 601 West Nassau Street label was put on there. If the mailing address under the label wasn't for Ruth Payne, the question is, why was the parcel in the Irving post office and not in the Dallas post office, which is where the mailing label said that it was supposed to be sent? While Ruth Payne's role in the paper bag parcel story was limited to speculating about what was in the package, on the day of the assassination, Ruth and her husband were accused of something far more nefarious. On November 26th, Captain Paul Barger advised the FBI that, quote, he had received information that a male voice was overheard in a conversation which took place between the Payne residence and Michael Payne's employer, Bell Helicopter. Informant advised that the male voice was heard to comment that he felt sure Lee Harvey Oswald had killed the president, but did not feel Oswald was responsible, and further stated, quote, we both know who is responsible. The FBI report says the exact time of this call was not known and that it happened on Saturday, November 23rd. But subsequent phone records demonstrated that the call between the Payne residence and Bell Helicopter was actually on the Friday of the assassination. While both Ruth and Michael Payne vehemently denied having foreknowledge of the assassination, they did both confirm multiple times to the Warren Commission that they spoke to one another on the telephone on the day of the assassination, with Michael calling the Payne residence from his job at Bell Helicopter. This allegation is absolutely explosive, but like everything else in the JFK assassination, it is intensely disputed, and there's another side to the story. On January 17th, almost 2 months after Captain Berger first told the FBI about the call, FBI agent James Hostie followed up with Berger to get more information about how he found out about this phone call. Berger said that he had been assigned to, quote, obtain a list of telephone tickets or other helpful information from the Southwestern States Telephone Company, and that he, quote, felt sure the information he previously furnished the FBI with had come from some telephone company sources, but he was still unable to identify the individual who related it to him. In this January 17th interview with Agent Hosty, Captain Barger gave a different story about the content of the phone call between the Paynes. He had originally said that Ruth and Michael Payne both agreed that someone else was responsible. But in Barger's retelling of the story 2 months later, he said that the male voice said, quote, "Oswald would not have had any reason to do it, but when you get right down to it, the only guilty person is that bastard himself." Keep in mind, this phone call, for which there is a phone record, was at 1 o'clock on the day of the assassination, just 25 minutes after the shots were fired. At that time, no one knew who Lee Harvey Oswald was, and there was no way that the Paynes could have known that Oswald was the one who shot Kennedy, unless they just assumed that Oswald did it since he worked at the depository. But that's a pretty big assumption to make. In a 1976 Dallas Times-Herald article, Captain Barger told reporter Hugh Ainsworth that the source of the information about the call was a telephone repairman who was working on the line and incidentally overheard the conversation. Warren Report critics note that there are at least two reasons why the phone call from Michael to Ruth Payne that day could have been recorded. First, Payne's home line could have been tapped because Marina lived there, and the CIA had at least 29 reasons to think that Marina was a KGB agent, according to an internal CIA report. Second, Michael worked at Bell Helicopter, a major military contractor, which was a business that very likely could have had its phones tapped, given the sensitive nature of the industry it was in. On the day of the assassination, shortly after Oswald was taken into custody, Detective Gus Rose was sent to the Payne home in Irving. As soon as the police arrived, they walked up to the porch, and Ruth Payne said, quote, "I've been expecting you all. Come right in. As soon as I heard where the shooting happened, I knew there would be someone out." Buddy Walters also confirmed this "we've been expecting you" statement from Ruth Payne. Warren Commission Counsel Wesley Liebler thought that Payne's statement was strange and asked Buddy Walters, quote, "How do you account for the fact that Mrs. Payne said, 'Come on in, we've been expecting you'?" And Walters responded, quote, "I don't know. To this day, I don't know." Within minutes of the police being on site at the Payne residence, Michael Payne showed up at the house and told Detective Rose, quote, "I came to help you. Just as soon as I heard where it happened, I knew that you would need some help." Ruth confirmed in her Warren Commission testimony that she had not heard on television that Oswald had been arrested at the time the police arrived. Payne knew that Lee worked at the school book depository building and that shots had come from there, but she had no other reason to suspect Oswald. Neither did Michael Payne. So why would Ruth tell the police that she had been expecting them? And why would Michael tell the police that he knew they would need some help? One of the most significant findings at the Payne home was a set of filing cabinets that was discovered by Sheriff Buddy Walters. Walters told the Warren Commission, quote, "Then we found some little metal cabinets. They would carry an 8x10 folder, all right? But with a single handle on top of it, and the handle moves." Regarding these filing cabinets, Commission Counsel Liebler asked Walters, quote, "I have been advised that some story has developed that at some point when you went out there, you found 7 file cabinets full of cards that had the names of pro-Castro sympathizers or something of that kind, but you don't remember seeing any of them." To which Walters replied, quote, "Well, that could have been one, but I didn't see it. I picked up all these file cabinets, and what all of them contained, I don't know myself to this day." This story about the pro-Castro sympathizer cards in the metal filing cabinet didn't just originate from thin air. It came from Walther's written statement on the day of the assassination that he provided to Sheriff Bill Decker. In that document, Walther said, quote, "Also found was a set of metal file cabinets containing records that appeared to be names and activities of Cuban sympathizers." We previously talked about how Michael Payne and Oswald would often go to meetings of left-wing groups and right-wing groups. For Oswald, it's always assumed that he's an enthusiastic leftist, which explains why he would go to left-wing meetings and also why he would go to right-wing meetings, because he supposedly hated right-wingers and wanted to learn about them. But we can't forget that Michael Payne also regularly attended all sorts of different political meetings. His reason for attending those meetings is generally thought to be mere curiosity. But is it possible that Michael Payne was gathering intelligence on these outlier political groups? According to an FBI report, a man named Ed Buck and his friend Betty Mann had a notable interaction with a stranger at Luby's restaurant in April or May of 1963. The stranger struck up a conversation with Buck and Mann while they were standing in line. He began talking about how the U.S. was being too hard on Cuba. The stranger then asked Buck if he had ever met an ex-Marine who lived in Russia and married a Russian girl, but Buck said that he had not. This stranger then sat with Buck and Mann while they ate. He said that he worked at Bell Helicopter and that he lived in Fort Worth, but he came to Luby's restaurant near Southern Methodist University regularly so that he could engage in interesting conversations with students. After the assassination, Buck was shown several photos of people by the FBI to see if he could identify this talkative stranger. Buck said that he was certain that the photo of Michael Payne was identical to the man he met at Luby's. This FBI report about Ed Buck and Betty Mann's interaction with Michael Payne, combined with the meetings Payne attended with Oswald and the metal file folders full of names and activities of Cuban sympathizers that were noted in Buddy Walther's original report, strongly suggests that Michael Payne may have been collecting intelligence.
How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, "Happy Friday!" Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico. How do you feel when you switch to Geico and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, "Happy Friday!" Then you check your phone quickly and discover today's actually Friday. So yes, happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with Geico feels just like that. Get more with Geico.
It makes sense that the Paynes would come up in the investigation into Lee Harvey Oswald. His wife and children were living with Ruth Payne, and many of Oswald's belongings were in the Payne garage. The question we all must answer is what level of involvement from the Paynes, Ruth in particular, is explainable and innocent, and how much involvement is unreasonable to the point of being suspicious. There were many key pieces of evidence against Oswald that were found at the Payne home. This evidence includes the blanket in the Payne garage that police said had the imprint of a rifle, the backyard photograph of Oswald with the rifle and the pistol, the photos of General Walker's house, the Imperial Reflex camera that was allegedly used to take the backyard photos and the photos of General Walker's house, the incriminating note that Oswald allegedly wrote to Marina after the General Walker shooting, which was found in a book by Ruth Payne, a piece of luggage that no one else saw Oswald with that had markings from the bus that Oswald was allegedly on in Mexico City, and the incendiary letter that Oswald supposedly wrote to the Soviet embassy that seems to confirm his Mexico City trip and imply that he's working with the Soviets. Incidentally, the FBI confirmed that this letter came from Ruth Payne's typewriter and that it was the only letter the FBI could find that was ever written from that typewriter. That is a lot of evidence to come from the Payne home. But as a practical matter, much of the evidence came from Oswald's bag in the garage, which is where it would be if he really was guilty. So while it does seem like Ruth Payne just keeps showing up with new evidence to incriminate Oswald, in my view, the evidence that she produced alone is not enough to view her with suspicion. However, when we combine what we know about the evidence she provided with other actions that she took, things get more interesting. There's the way that Ruth Payne met the Oswalds, at a party where the main event was to watch George de Morenschild's travel films through Latin America. The party itself is not suspicious, primarily because Everett Glover, the party's host, says that he met Ruth through singing at the church. But then again, if the claims from Joseph Dreyer that we discussed in episode 41 are true, Ruth Payne's father was acquainted with George de Morenschild, which would make her meeting the Oswalds at this party a major coincidence. After they were first introduced, Ruth pursues a relationship with Marina and begins asking her to move in. Ruth then shows up unannounced right as the Oswalds were headed to the bus station to leave for New Orleans and convinces Marina to stay with her for a few days while Lee looked for work. Then, Ruth gave Marina and June a ride to New Orleans. Ruth and Marina wrote letters to each other while the Oswalds were living in the Big Easy. Then, Ruth came to pick Marina and June up, and she took almost all of the family's belongings, including a bag that, according to the Warren Report, contained Oswald's rifle, even though no one remembers seeing the rifle at the time the car was packed. From this point until the assassination, Marina and her children would live at the Payne home, and most of Oswald's possessions would be stored in their garage. As noted last episode, it also appears that Ruth guided Oswald to get the job at the Texas School Book Depository Building. Several potential employers for Oswald were discussed by the concerned mothers who were trying to brainstorm where he could get a job. But Ruth focused exclusively on the depository building and even called to get Oswald an interview. And when Oswald had a better paying and permanent job opportunity at Trans-Texas Airlines, only Ruth was aware of this opportunity, and it appears that she never told Oswald. Aside from Ruth pursuing Marina to live with her, getting Oswald the job at the depository, and providing a lot of incriminating evidence to the authorities, there are other reasons to question her claims that she was an innocent bystander to history. As we discussed in episode 42, Ruth and Michael Payne have an uncanny amount of connections to intelligence agencies. Michael's mom's close friend was CIA agent Mary Bancroft, who was Alan Dulles' mistress. The father of a character witness for the Paynes, Frederick Osborne, was Alan Dulles' close friend at Princeton. And Michael Payne's stepdad was an inventor at military contractor Bell Helicopter, where Michael worked and had a high-level security clearance. As for Ruth, her father tried to work for the CIA, but ended up being an executive for USAID, which was a CIA cutout, at the time he worked there. Ruth's sister, Sylvia Hoke, was an employee of the CIA. The Paynes were not just regular people. They definitely had connections. Whether those connections mean anything is for you to judge. It's also true that Ruth and Michael Payne were Quakers, a religion that regularly worked with intelligence agencies after World War I. In fact, the practice of Quakers working with intelligence was so common that by 1960, all Quaker and Unitarian welfare agencies were placed under suspicion by the KGB. On top of that, Michael Payne connected Oswald with the General Walker shooting in an article in the Houston Post on the day after the assassination. This is the first time Oswald was ever linked to the General Walker shooting. There are markings in Ruth Payne's pocket calendar for the March 20th date that Oswald allegedly ordered the rifle. Payne said that she wrote this information down on November 23rd, even though the notation in the calendar says October 23rd. Finally, Jim Garrison claimed that he subpoenaed the federal tax returns of Ruth and Michael Payne and was told that he could not access them due to national security. And during the Garrison trial, Marina said that she was told by Secret Service agents not to hang out with Ruth Payne because Payne was affiliated with the CIA. One thing that could potentially shed light on Payne's motives is looking at what she did with the rest of her life after the JFK assassination. Ruth became the principal of a Quaker school in Pennsylvania before moving to Florida, where she worked for the rest of her career as a school psychologist. In the late 1980s, after Ruth was retired, she began to work with ProNICA, a Quaker-affiliated organization that was dedicated to helping the people of Nicaragua recover from the years of fighting between the Sandinistas and the CIA-backed Contras. Eventually, Payne became the director of this organization. Sue Wheaton was an American volunteer for a religious group in Nicaragua that worked with the Sandinistas, the group that the CIA-backed Contras had fought against. Wheaton met Ruth Payne in Nicaragua in 1991 and quickly began to suspect that Payne was some sort of intelligence agent. Most of the members of Wheaton's group were stridently anti-war and were concerned about the military actions that were being threatened in the Middle East at the time. She remembers that Ruth downplayed how severe war in Iraq would be by questioning how many civilians would really be hurt in a war. She also once hinted that she knew someone at the embassy, but was not open with the group about who she knew or how she knew them. Ruth had a photographer with her in Nicaragua, Sean Miller, who was frequently taking pictures. Ruth said that Miller was a student at Antioch College and he was taking photos for the Nicaragua network. But the photographer, Miller, said he lived in Washington, D.C. And when Wheaton asked the Nicaragua network about Sean Miller's photos, they didn't know anything about it. Payne also took copious notes in all meetings, including writing down the names on the membership list. But there are some counterpoints to Wheaton's reasons to suspect Ruth Payne as being an intelligence agent. First, Ruth always took notes. It was part of her personality. And according to Warren Report defenders, the Sue Wheaton story about Ruth Payne is really just a self-fulfilling prophecy because many of the people in Wheaton's group were believers in a JFK assassination conspiracy and were already aware of Payne's role in the assassination. So they didn't like her or trust her from the beginning. Ultimately, for most people, the Nicaragua story reinforces everything that they already believe about Ruth Payne. She's either somehow involved in framing Lee Harvey Oswald, or she's an innocent woman who was the victim of a series of coincidences that makes it appear that she was involved in framing Oswald. Michael Payne passed away in 2018. Ruth is still alive today. She lives in Santa Rosa, California, and continues to vehemently deny any involvement with intelligence agencies or framing Lee Harvey Oswald. Next time on Solving JFK, we look at instances of alleged foreknowledge of the JFK assassination. Then we turn our attention to more impersonations of Lee Harvey Oswald leading up to the assassination of President Kennedy. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit SolvingJFKPodcast.com for more information.
How do you feel when you switch to GEICO and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, "Happy Friday!" Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with GEICO feels just like that. Get more with GEICO. How do you feel when you switch to GEICO and save on your car insurance? It's like going to work on one Thursday morning and thinking to yourself, just one more day until Friday. But then somebody in the elevator says, "Happy Friday!" Then you check your phone quickly and discover today is actually Friday. So yes, happy Friday, random stranger in the elevator. Happy Friday indeed. Yep, switching and saving with GEICO feels just like that. Get more with GEICO.